Hi, it's Edwin McCain. You're listening to Life Minute TV.
He's the singer-songwriter behind one of the 90s most romantic songs.
And I'll be your crying shoulder. I'll be love's suicide.
I'll Be, Edwin McCain's 1997 hit, climbed the Billboard Hot 100 charts and was featured in an array of shows and movies over the past few decades. Since, he's released a total of 11 studio albums. His latest, Lucky, produced by friend and country star Lee Bryce, is his first in 15 years. The father of three continues to capture a whole new generation of fans through the viral success of his hilarious TikTok account featuring his daughter, and most recently as a contestant on The Masked Singer Season 13. The artist also just wrapped a tour with Hootie and the Blowfish, Collective Soul, and Lee Bryce, and will hit the road again this summer with Train. He came by the Life Minute Studios to tell us all about the new album, touring, and to perform his biggest ballad, as well as a brand new track. This is a Life Minute with Edwin McCain.
Lee Bryce, he claims me as like one of his big influences. He used to come to my shows when he was a teenager, which makes me feel old.
Edwin McCain, first of all, my hero growing up. There was Garth, Edwin.
For about 10 years, he was after me to make a record with him. And at the time, I was sort of in this mindset of, well, you know, I've put out 10 albums and I've still go out and play my shows and I tease my audience. I go, tonight I'm only going to play new songs. And they're like, no. And I'm guilty of that too, because I love AC/DC, but when I go hear them, I want to hear Back in Black and For Those About to Rock. I just kind of always chalked it up to, I'm just going to go and play the songs that they want to hear, and nobody cares about hearing anything new from me. And then Lee kept pushing and pushing, and I just love him. He's such a good dude. I was like, all right, let's make a record. Why not?
Taught me everything I didn't know about playing acoustic guitar and singing.
And in the time that from the last record I made until now, the technology is even better. And so it makes the potential landscape of music so much wider. But it also allows for you to endlessly edit. It used to be your album was finished when you ran out of studio time and money. And now it's just, you have to stop. You just have to say, here it is. This is why. Because you can just edit for endless time. Lee, I met him through a friend of mine, a songwriter in Nashville named Philip Lammons. And he was writing with Lee. And he kept calling me going, dude, this guy's like super famous and he's like a fan of yours and you need to come meet him. I was like, okay, because I was in the mix of raising like toddlers, like small kids, and I didn't know anything. I know Phineas and Ferb, you know, I don't know current country music. And so I went and met him and we wrote, and he's such a great musician and a great singer, and it was one of those, immediately I'm going to be friends with him. And it's been one of those great friendships. Well, again, yet another friendship I made through music. And that's the best part about this whole thing. It was the most fun record I've ever made. It's kind of all over the place. It touches on a lot of genres. It veered a little bit more country. I mean, we always sort of veered into Americana, but we kind of veered all the way into country with the Old Dominion song Lucky. And thanks to Matt Ramsey, because I tend to write sad songs. And so when I got into the studio, I was like, oh my gosh, I got a pile of sad songs here. I got to do something. And so I called Matt and I was like, do you have a happy song I can borrow for this record? And he sent over Lucky. But some guys just get lucky all the time. And I recorded it, but it sounded so much like an Old Dominion song. I was like, people are going to think I'm ripping you off. You got to be on this song with me. And so he graciously appeared on the song too. So that was cool. Empire, I wrote it after going and seeing this EDM artist called Illenium. You know, I'm a Gen Xer, so, you know, I was like, EDM, you know, and I'd never seen it, and so I went, and it was a revelation, because he's a musician, and he created a 4.5 hour long experience. It was an epiphany for me, because as the night went on, it built and built, and I'm 100% sure that every laser that was available in Los Angeles County was in that building, along with the fire effects. And as the night went on, you know, he was bringing out different singers and different, and then more musicians. And by the end of the show, there was two drummers and a stage full of musicians. So it wasn't just EDM, it was a hybrid. If the goal be to create an experience and be entertaining, mission accomplished. It was amazing. But I think the big takeaway for me was the vibe in the room and the spirit of the people, the kids that were there. And I say kids, the 20s somethings that were in there. There was this overwhelming sense of independence, and they are untouched by a lot of the ugliness that's going on outside in the world. And I was like, man, the kids are gonna be okay. And that was my takeaway from it. And I walked away going, you know what? Give it to them. They're gonna be okay. There's another song on the album called Helicopter that I wrote for my mother.
I'll take you on a helicopter ride. Get a glimpse of what it will be like when you take to the skies.
Her final bucket list item was she wanted to take a helicopter ride around the mountain that she lived her whole life on. And so I made it happen. And so it's sort of a chronicle of that moment. And then Don't Go Chasing a Memory, the sort of the opening track of the record, I co-wrote with my longtime friend Maya Sharp. Kind of reminded myself of being present in this endeavor, because when I was in my 20s and on the major labels, we forgot to enjoy the moments because we were so busy driving towards things and our schedules were insane. And I think there was such a sense of desperation, like if the numbers next week don't come out right, we're gonna lose. You know, meanwhile, we're out there playing shows every night and sometimes missing the point. I know that I'm not like that anymore. Every gig I get, now that I'm 35 years in, I still get to do this. Pretty cool. Maya Sharp is my main co-writer, and my relationship with her has been spectacular. She's one of the greatest songwriters I've ever known, but even more than that, just an even better human. And she taught me how to really bring a song to its best and highest. And the idea being that if you don't develop an idea to the best version that it can be, is that it's disrespectful to other writers that would've. And I had never seen it like that until we met and started working together. I think that changed my trajectory as a songwriter for sure. I think that it's hard to give credit to the lightning rod for the lightning. I think as artists or musicians, we're just hoping to get out under the stormy cloud and hopefully we get hit with it and pass it out. That's all we're trying to do, is just be a conduit. I'll Be has been my ticket to planet Earth. About 10 minutes before I finished the song, my former boss at Atlantic, a guy named Jason Flom, called me and was like, listen, some of the people here are talking about dropping you from the label, so the next thing you turn in needs to be great. And I was like, oh, okay. I got this one song, it's really coming together. And so it was like a half court hook shot at the buzzer, and it went in. So I was really lucky. It was sort of an amalgam of things. It was something that I used to say to this girl I was dating. You know, we both kind of knew it wasn't going to work out, but I used to say, I'll always be your greatest fan. And then the crying shoulder part was just, this drunk guy fumbled his words. He meant to say shoulder to cry on, and he just blurted out crying shoulder. And I turned and was like, yeah, I got to write that down. Yeah, that was it. And back then, too, I was just kind of bouncing around a lot. So wherever I was, I would write little phrases on napkins and receipts or whatever and just throw them in my bag. And then when I would get home from tour, I'd pull out all these little fragments and put them on the coffee table and just kind of go through them and go, does any of this work together? And that's kind of how it came together. Better when I'm older. I think that was a little bit of a prayer, because at the time I didn't have a healthy relationship with substances, and I knew that eventually I was going to have to face that, but I wasn't ready. And so that was sort of a projection, I guess. I hoped that I would, all right, you're going to have to get this under control at some point, and so I'll be better when I'm older. It's either that or I was just putting it off in the lyric. Every night when I play it, I try to think, well, I want to play this like the first time I ever played it. I want to do this as good as possible. I'm never tired of it. I'm grateful for it, for everything it's ever been. You know, to have a hit song is amazing, but then to have one that lasts for 30 years, I don't even know how to quantify that. You know, every decade sort of has its moment where the nostalgia kicks in, and the people that grew up on the music are in their 40s and 50s, and they've gotten to a place in their life where they're looking back and sort of taking stock on the things they loved and then things they love. And so we're right in that moment now. And a lot of the artists that came out in the 90s are still out playing. And we're sort of just finding each other again and, you know, grouping up and going out and playing shows, which is a lot of fun. And I think we benefited from being the last class of the big time music business from the, you know, early 90s through 99. I think you could arguably say was the zenith of the record industry. It's not lost on me how lucky we were to be when we were. So, and I think the so many people attached lifetime memories to that era of music that we get to go back out and flip through the photo album. My son, I caught him in the shower. I could hear him through the door. He was singing yacht rock. He was like singing an Ambrosia song. And I was like, what? So when he got out, I was like, where'd you hear that? And he goes, Grand Theft Auto. And so that video game, you can tune the channels. And so it has 80s, 90s, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. And they learn all this music. And it goes to show you that a good song's a good song, and it'll hit any generation. It doesn't, you know, but the way that they consume music is interesting, because, and I've watched them kind of go through phases with SoundCloud, and they're a lot less loyal to the brands. You know, they drift in and out of music that they like. I guess secretly I always wanted to do music as a career. Like a lot of Southerners, I was in church choir. It's like Southern daycare. As a kid, I was dyslexic, so I couldn't read. I had a really hard time in elementary school, but I could sing. And so, you know how it is. Like, everybody likes it when I'm singing, so I was singing, man. Listen, because I'm not reading anything for you. When I left for college, my father woke me up and said, listen, I had this terrible nightmare that you were riding around the country playing music, and promise me you're not going to do that. And at the time, I was like, okay, yeah, I promise, whatever. And then when I got to college, I was like, well, this isn't fun at all. Like, I'm sitting in a political science class? Nah. So I started busking on the street in Charleston and quickly picked up a gig at this little Mexican restaurant. I was busking on the sidewalk in front of this place, and the manager came out and goes, hey, if I pay you $75 and feed you a meal, can you play here 3 nights a week? And I was like, I went and dropped out of college the next day. I was like, I'm rich. And that was it, man. Like, once I figured out how to support myself playing music, that was it. That's all we were gonna do. My first biggest influence, I would say, is Earth, Wind & Fire. That was sort of the moment I was 7 years old and I put on headphones and put on this album called All in All, and the first track is called Serpentine Fire. 7-year-old brain blown. Yeah, I went through a phase of Southern California. It was all R&B and soul in the beginning, and then it was the Van Halen phase, there was hair metal phase, and then there was Southern California punk music phase that sort of morphed into a songwriter in Asheville, North Carolina named David Wilcox. He's really a wordsmith. And so this weird amalgam of all of that ended me up here. I don't know how else to describe it, but I was always R&B over the, all my friends were listening to the Beatles and the Doors, and I was listening to Spencer Davis Group and Tower of Power. So that was it. So about 16 and a half or so years ago, like a lot of people that struggle with substance use disorder, I had sort of come to the end. And the end is sort of this bad logic that you get to where you're like, I can't stop this. And that, well, there's one way that'll stop it. And so you come to this sort of really bad logic, and in a sort of final moment of like, well, maybe we should try treatment before we go that drastic. And I did. I went and checked into a place called Talbot in Atlanta and stayed there for 120 days and learned about what was going on and began the process of rebuilding. It was the best thing I ever did. I talk about it openly whenever I'm asked, because it's been 16 better years, and I'm here today because of it. So just go ahead and start now. You know, I put it off for a long time, and I was really high functioning. I did great. You know, I was earning at a very high level when I checked in to rehab. Earning is not a gauge of how healthy you are as a human. And I misunderstood so many things about what was happening, and it's a complicated little game of Jenga we got going on between our ears, and it's real easy to get out of balance. It's also easy to get it back. Well, I shouldn't say easy. It's work to get it back, but it's not impossible. But it's the best thing you can do for yourself. And most of the time, when anybody has that, you hear it in the back of your mind, man, I'm gonna have to get this under control. As soon as you have that conversation with yourself, no better time than the present, I say. Train, I used to sit in with them a long time ago. In fact, I had this moment where I was weirdly invited to go to the Playboy Mansion or sit in with Train, and I was like, I'm gonna go sit in with Train. That sounds like way more fun. So I've been friends with them, gosh, since the early 90s. I look forward to reconnecting with Pat. I mean, what a great writer. I mean, his songs are amazing. So hopefully I can sit in and sing some of those songs with him too. As far as people that I've loved working with, the list is too long, because all the bands from our era, the friendships are truly the currency of this journey, because the success or the money, it comes and goes, but the friendships are really what's special about it, because you can go anywhere and you have friends. You make friends all over the world. I have some friends that are like super famous, and so the way I show them love is not by calling them, because I know they're buried under, they know that when I'm not in contact with them, that's how I show them love, because I'm just not another person piling on. So it's different in a lot of different ways. And it goes in waves, right? Like I just spent last summer with Hootie and Collective Soul, and we had the best whole summer. And my manager, who's been around the block a few times, he started out with Queen. He's been on hundreds of tours. He came up to me about halfway through and he said, I've never seen a tour where the bands get along as well as y'all do. And I was like, I know, right? They're all college friends. So it does. It goes in waves. Like, there's periods of time where I'm in contact with certain bands all the time, and then you go in little gaps, but you always pick up where you left off. I'd love to work with Seal, but I can almost guarantee you he doesn't want to work with me. I am embarrass myself in front of him so bad a year ago, I just barged up to him at this thing and just started talking. And it was, I couldn't stop myself. And then when I finally did stop myself, I just walked away like, oh. We're kind of mercenary when it comes to this tour. I travel light. We got fussed at last summer because I didn't have anything on my rider except for water and towels. And the production manager for this big tour we were on were like, come on, man, really just going to go water and towels? And I was like, well, that's kind of all we need. And so they were like, well, that's embarrassing. So they put chips and salsa and like Fritos or something on there too. So we would at least have something in there. But yeah, I'm not very precious about it. I mean, we've been doing this for 35 years. I drive the bus. I don't know. I was always around bands like the Aquarium Rescue Unit and Warren Haynes and the Allman Brothers, and they're not very precious about it. And everybody sort of treats it like journeyman. So I've always sort of approached it like that too. I just walk out and start singing. I try not to think about it too much because I think there was a period of time where I was thinking about it too much and it made it worse. You just created anxiety when there didn't need to be. I mean, now I just walk out and pick up my guitar and sing. That's it. I play music from, I think I get at least music from 10 albums into the show. And I'll pick up an audible from the crowd every once in a while too. I have a set list, but everybody laughs. Guys in my band laugh at me because I literally, it's just suggestions. I veer off that set list within three songs. I'm doing something different. Now it's so much easier to do new music, and I have some orphans left over that didn't make this record, so I guess after an appropriate amount of time, I'm going to release three more songs and then just release three more songs. And I think that seems to be the way everybody's doing it, is they just can constantly release new songs over the course of a year, and I've already got three or four almost finished. It's funny how I like this music business way better than the music business that I was in the 90s. Yeah, it's way cooler. There have been a lot of the TikTok artists that I've been turned on to. There's a kid that's opening for me for the next two shows that I saw on a TikTok live, was flipping through and was like, what is this? And contacted him and he's coming to play. And I've had multiple people from TikTok come and open. And I wasn't a TikToker. In fact, I was like the worst Gen Xer that was like, never social media, man, you know. And then COVID hit and I was homeschooling my kids and I bumbled into TikTok. And immediately, like everybody, I got sucked in. But the thing that really sucked me in was the highest value of it is authenticity. And I was like, oh, wait a second. Now you can just be yourself? Because that was the part about the industry I didn't like, is that there was always sort of this pretense and they're always building this mystery. And I was like, wait a second, I can just get on here and be me? 100% in. But one of the other things that I loved about it immediately was I was able to see other people's perspective. If you're willing to spend time and listen to other people's experience, you can learn so much. And I think it sort of grows your empathy and it allows you to hear people, and you can almost instantly know if people are being performative. Like the authenticity is the highest part of this, and the people that, and I've made friends on TikTok, and I love the community, and I've made friends and learned things I would never have learned, and you know, and for all the negative things that social media has, I see a lot of positive that comes from people understanding each other better. And it's daily, I'll see musicians on social media that are just staggeringly great at a young age. I can say this without fear of contradiction, that the level of talent at their age is so much better than we were at 20. You know, they're 20-something year old musicians, and you just go, wow. And the writing is deep, and they're, you know, the execution is flawless. It's It's impressive.
Okay, this is your, this is it. This is the last chance. Just tell each other you love each other.
My kids are regularly embarrassed by my existence, which I think is the way it's supposed to be, right? Like, my son is really knowledgeable about all kinds of different music, and my daughter has pretty eclectic tastes. None of them want to be musicians. I think for them, you know, they, like, my son, my middle son, when he was in third grade, they were doing, like, what's your dad do? He told his class that I run a forklift at a warehouse, which he's seen me, because we have a warehouse and I have a forklift there. And in his mind, well, that's his job, because he's seen me play music, but that can't be a job, right? That's just a hobby. And so I kind of always thought that was funny. Like, my dad drives a forklift. Yeah, well, that's true. I'm a pilot. I probably would have flown airplanes if I didn't play music for a living. You know, I really used to fly all the time. And then once you have kids, like, I kind of started peeling off the flying, you know. I sold my motorcycle and stopped flying airplanes. And, you know, you got to be around. You got to be able to take care of them. I have side hustles where I move dirt around for people. I have heavy equipment, so I enjoy that a lot. So I know it sounds insane, but if you haven't sat in an excavator and listened to a book on tape all day, you're living an incomplete life. I have a farm, and I build habitat for all the little critters. And so I like building habitat and seeing turkeys and quail and stuff, deer and stuff thrive. I don't really hunt them. I just like making habitat for all the little creatures.
So I'm delivering the boat to Darius. It's been a long road. He's not going to believe the transformation.
I did this show a while back called Flipping Ships, and it was sort of based around my love of restoring old things. But after about 6 episodes of doing television, I was like, I don't want to do television anymore. Television's weird. Or, well, I tell you this, I would do television again as long as I'm not, like, producing and writing and doing all the stuff. Like, I want to just be told what to do. It'd be fine. Find the balance between have to and want to. That's what life is. You find a good balance between what you have to do and what you want to do. And there's a sweet spot in there. I'd like to be able to play for as, I mean, as long as I'm performing at a high level and I feel like what I'm doing is good, I'd like to see how long I can do it. I found years ago, I understand the concept of enough. Like, I've been beyond lucky in this life to be able to do this for 35 years. It's not lost on me that the reason that is because people come to the shows, and I love seeing the same faces as we travel around. And I'm just really grateful to everybody that's let me do this for this long. I haven't put unrealistic expectations on myself. I did early on, and I think that's what you do when you're in your 20s. But then substituting gratitude for avarice is the best thing I've done. I love the guys I play with. Some of them have been with me for 35 years, and I'm proud of lasting this long. You know, hopefully I can make another 5 or 10 years. We'll see.
The strands in your eyes that call to them wonderful stab me, steal my breath. Emeralds from mountains thrust towards the sky, never revealing their depth. And tell me that we belong together. Dress it up with the trappings of love. I'll be captivated. I'll hang from your lips. Stare down the gallows of heartache that hang from above. Crying shoulder, I'll be love suicide. And I'll be better when I'm older. I'll be the greatest fan of your life. And rain falls angry on the tin roof as we lie awake in my bed. You're my survival, you're my living proof. My love is alive, not dead. And tell me that we belong together. Dress it up with the trappings of love. I'll be captivated, I'll hang from your lips. Stare down the gallows of heartache that hang from above. And I'll be your crying shoulder. I'll be love's suicide. And I'll be better when I'm older. I'll be the greatest fan of your life. And I dropped out, burned up, found my way back from the dead. Tuned it, turned on, remember the thing that you said. And I'll be your crying shoulder, I'll be love suicide. And I'll be better when I'm older. I'll be the greatest fan of your life. If this world should break you, pick your pieces up. Wherever the road takes you, I'll be there in the dust. Your stars fade to nothing, your dreams start to rust. Shall I pray it doesn't? I pray it doesn't. But when it does, and you feel like heaven's falling. And when it does, you don't know who to trust. I can't stop your river rising. I promise you the water won't get rough. But I'll be right here beside you when it does. Know what it's like to cry out when all you got is prayer. All you hear is silence, makes you wonder if God was ever there. And I can feel your faith disappear into the air. Child, I hope it doesn't. I pray it doesn't. But when it does, and you feel like heaven's falling. When it does, and you don't know who to trust. And I can't stop your river rising. I promise you the water won't get rough. And I'll be right here beside you when it does. Ain't no wrong we can't right, no fight we can't fight. The truth is, child, trouble's gonna come. But when it does, and you feel like heaven's falling, when it does, you don't know who to trust. I can't stop your river rising. I promise you the water won't get rough. I wish I could stop the world from beating you up, but I'll be right here beside you when it does.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.